You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of March 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
It was the noise I heard, first of all. It appeared to be like gunshot wounds. I'm not saying that they were. And then I just saw a car go out of control and just go into pedestrians on the bridge.
At least two people killed, including a police officer, and several more injured in London in what police are treating as a terrorist incident outside the Houses of Parliament. We'll have the latest from Westminster, plus my guests Sebastian Borger and Phil Clark will be here to discuss the day's other top stories, including a grand gathering of the coalition fighting Islamic State, a papal apology for the Catholic Church's behaviour in Rwanda, and Scotland, if its Parliament does back another independence referendum, then what? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, and Phil Clark, reader in comparative and international politics at SOAS here in London. Welcome both. We will start tonight in London, where reports breaking just as we go to air suggest that at least four people have now confirmed dead and several more injured in what police have said they are treating as a terrorist incident. A motorist ran down pedestrians on Westminster Bridge near the Houses of Parliament and stabbed a police officer. A suspect has been shot by police. Before we speak to some people who were at the scene, here is a little of what we have heard so far today.
Order! I am now going to suspend the sitting of the House.
I was just walking across the bridge and suddenly a bus stopped and everybody started screaming.
It was the noise I heard, first of all. It appeared to be like gunshot wounds. I'm not saying that they were. And then I just saw a car go out of control and just go into pedestrians on the bridge.
It's our priority to keep London safe. People going home this evening will see additional officers deployed, both armed and unarmed, across London in order to achieve that aim.
Gunshots fired. I'm joined now by Torquil Crichton, Westminster editor at the Daily Record, who was at the Houses of Parliament when the incident took place. He's still there in lockdown at Westminster Hall. He joins us now. Torquil, first of all, what was the first you heard of what occurred this afternoon?
Gunshots rang out. Unmistakable bang bang of gunfire. Ironically, just as a division bell summoning MPs to go and vote was ringing out at the same time. So just as MPs were going to do their democratic business, democracy was taken to, was halted. We are upstairs. The journalists are all in rooms overlooking New Palace Yard, the scene of this incident. We all rushed to the windows, sweeping aside the bomb-proof curtains that save us from fragments in the event of an explosion. We looked down the cobbled yard below. It's in the shadow of Big Ben. You could see two men lying on the ground. Paramedics were giving attention to the two. I rushed downstairs into the yard, but we were met by armed police surging out of their armoury in the underground car park. They took up point, just like you'd see an armed patrol in an occupied country. They pointed their guns, they hid behind the sandstone pillars, and they ordered us to get back inside. Democracy on lockdown.
And what have they said since? You said you're still on lockdown in Westminster Hall. Do the police appear confident that the incident has been dealt with?
It appears to have been a lone knife man with two knives who appears to have driven across Westminster Bridge on the pavement, crowded, always crowded, constantly crowded with tourists. The best view of the Palace of Westminster is from that bridge that spans the Thames. He seems to have crashed his car into the fortified wall of the palace, and then as ordinary people surged in through the open gates to get away from him, he jumped the barrier and went for a policeman. According to a colleague who saw the incident unfold, the policeman went down and so did the attacker. But as a second policeman approached, the attacker got up and had a go at him. Then there was gunfire.
And what, in terms of the police response, what was your sense of the extent to which they were acting on a predetermined pattern, the extent to which they'd rehearsed and practiced for exactly an event such as this?
Well, as I said, I rushed down to the yard myself only to be met with, you know, a senior commanding officer directing his armed men, armed with machine guns, to all points of the palace. They're well prepared. We see lots of guns around Westminster. We like guns in Westminster. They're always with the cops. They're here to protect us. And we know Parliament, Westminster, is the number one target. And in that sense, I guess they, as well as everybody else, was prepared for this day to come.
Torkel Creighton, Westminster editor of The Daily Record, thank you for joining us. Well, we're joined now by Michael Clark, specialist in security studies and former director general of the Royal United Services Institute. Michael is at Westminster right now. Michael, this is a major threat to security in the heart of Britain's government. What's your impression from where you're standing now of how it's been tackled?
Oh, I think the system's gone into operation the way it was supposed to, because this person who seems to have run into pedestrians and then stabbed a policeman was shot within about 15 yards. He was warned and then shot. That's as it was supposed to be. They immediately cordoned off the area. Obviously, they're looking at what else might be going on. There's danger that there might be a second attack or there might be other people involved. I mean, we've got no evidence of that, but they must cover for that. And so you can see there's a kind of a well-drilled operation taking place all around us. And in fact, in a different way, they practiced this last weekend. There was a big river-based exercise on Sunday that went through quite a lot of this. As far as that's concerned, it looks the way it should look, although the incident itself seems pretty nasty.
What is the imperative for the police in an attack like this? As you point out, they do plan for and rehearse for attacks of presumably exactly this sort. Is it to try and stop things from going on as fast as possible? Is it to try and get the public out of the way? What is their priority?
The priority, first of all, is public safety. So they're not trying to get the public completely out of the way, because in the centre of London you just can't. 9 million people all milling around at rush hour. So the first thing is secure the site to make sure that nothing else is going to happen. Secondly, check that this is not part of an ongoing incident, so that there isn't somebody else at large, or that it isn't part of a two-pronged attack, which in many other capitals it has been, as in France and Belgium. And then the third thing, of course, is secure the site for forensics, because they'll want to find out as much as they can about this. And so, putting tape around the site is quite important. So in effect, they've cleared about, I'm guessing, looking at it now, they've cleared about a quarter of a mile in every direction around Westminster. And apart from that, London's going on fairly normally.
And again, it must be something else they practice for quite intensely, but how important to the police in dealing with a situation like this is the tone the police themselves take in the immediate aftermath? The statements we've heard from Scotland Yard today have been noteworthy for their very measured tone, their very, very pronounced lack of any kind of fuss. How hard do they work on the right language and the right tone that will, I guess, prompt people to be appropriately cautious without causing panic?
Exactly right, yeah. To make people vigilant, but don't create a sense of immediate danger or panic. And they've learned a lot from the 7-7 incident in 2005. And if you remember there, 2 weeks after that incident, on the 7th of July, on the 21st of July 2005, there was another attempted attack, and there was a sense of some incipient panic. And when poor Charles de Menendez was shot completely accidentally, completely innocently at Stockwell Station, Ian Blair, the commissioner, was misinformed. He made a series of statements immediately, and then 12 hours after and 24 hours after, which all turned out to be false. And they learned a lot, because that didn't do the Metropolitan Police any good at all. They conducted themselves very well that day, apart from that dreadful tragedy of pursuing and shooting the wrong man. And the harm they did themselves there undid all the good they did everywhere else. So they've learned a lot from that experience, which is to make sure you get it right. Don't say anything until you absolutely know. And then when you do say something, make sure that it's said in the right tone. So they've learned their lessons, I think.
Michael Clark, thank you for joining us. It brings us back to the studio here with Phil Clark and Sebastian Borger. Sebastian, if this is a terror attack, and we should note that of the four now confirmed dead, one of them is believed to be the attacker. That means that there will be no reporting restrictions on this case, so we will learn a fair deal about this person fairly quickly. But if this is a terrorist attack, it's the first major incident, give or take such events as Leytonstone and Woolwich, since the bombings in 2005, which Michael was just referring to. What's your sense of how well London is protected, for given the kind of city it is?
Well, Andrew, when I listened to the police commander in charge, B.J. Harrington, he called it a terrorist incident. So I'm not sure why we don't call it a terrorist incident. Seems to me fairly clear. If I had been Lee Rigby, I would certainly call Woolwich a terrorist incident.
Well, indeed, so
in May 2013, I mean, the guy was knifed in broad daylight in a busy London street. If that isn't a terrorist incident, I don't know what is. I compare it, of course, to the terrorist attacks that we've had in my home country recently, and I'm very impressed with the London police. As Michael Clark pointed out, they clearly have learned their lessons. They to some extent overreacted back in 2005, very tragically, but understandably. But they seem to have found the right tone. They were quick. They were efficient. The guy was immobilized, unfortunately, obviously killed. But that was the risk he was clearly taking. I have nothing but praise.
Phil, on that subject of the definition of terrorism, which it is a tricky one to pin down, have we yet found the correct response to situations? And I'm not saying this is one of them, because we simply don't know yet, but mentioning things like the murder of Lee Rigby in Woolwich, the attempted murder of some hapless commuter at Leytonstone Tube Station, the people responsible for those, it's hard to tell whether they were actually consciously and deliberately acting in the cause of jihad, or whether they were just mentally ill people with drug problems, and to what extent that overlaps. And that we've seen that pattern again, time and time again, in Brussels, Paris, Nice. Are these people really holy warriors, or are they just unemployable stoners who've been attracted to this outlet for their rage?
Indeed. In fact, I think it's a scandal that the police are already calling this terrorism. I don't think they would have any grounds whatsoever to have divined the motive of the person who carried out this attack. I take it very seriously that the police commissioner is using that language, but I think it's almost certainly the case that he's doing that with no real insight into why this person committed this horrific act this afternoon. And I think in many ways the case that I would compare it to is, in fact, not 7/7 or the killing of Lee Rigby. I think perhaps the more pertinent case is the killing of Joe Cox, which was a case by clearly a right-wing fundamentalist. And the police there avoided using the term terrorism for the best part of 3 weeks until the trial began. So there does seem to be a profound double standard here, that when we see an act that I think the police and much of the public assumes was Islamically motivated, then it's okay to use the term terrorism. But if it's some other form of violent act, for example, a right-wing terrorism, then we're very reluctant to use that term. And I think in the current environment, where there is a febrile atmosphere around fears of Islamic violence and Islamic terrorism, the police need to be very, very cautious about using this kind of terminology. I don't, in fact, think they've been careful enough today.
It is, of course, Phil, just to follow that up, the conclusion that you can understand why people would leap to, but I was also reminded of the incident in Melbourne in January, where somebody ran down and killed 4 people with a car. There was an obvious assumption that was what we were looking at, but again, it turned out to be an act which, while terrible and terrorising, did not appear to be dictated by any political imperative at all.
Indeed, and I was looking at social media on the way to the studio, and already thousands of people have latched onto this idea that this is an act of Islamic terrorism, that they are borrowing the terrorist word used by the police and then adding what they think is the obvious extension. I must also say that there have been photographs of the dead assailant also being tweeted around, which have fueled this kind of language. So I think in this atmosphere, in this political environment around Brexit and concerns around Islam in the West, police need to be very, very careful about stirring up public sentiment.
Okay, well, let's move along slightly on a related subject, however, to Washington, D.C., where the U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson will today host representatives from all 68, count them, countries currently comprising the global coalition fighting Islamic State. It's the first such conclave since December 2014, and it comes at a time at which Islamic State does appear to be going backwards. The Iraqi military are clawing back Mosul, and next door in Syria, an unlikely alliance of Turks, Kurds, U.S. special forces, and sundry Syrian rebels are preparing for an assault on ISIS's putative capital of Raqqa. Sebastian, it's a question that has been asked hopefully many times before, but where Islamic State is concerned, are we nearing beginning of the end territory?
Well, as far as we can ascertain that from a studio in a warm studio in London, I would have thought, you know, it's everything that we hear from people who are there seems to point that way. Let's not go any further than that. And it seems to be as if the ragtag coalition that you just described has come together and has finally found a way of putting pressure on IS in a way which seems to be effective.
But Phil, is the threat of Islamic State diminished if their territory is also diminished? It does now appear inevitable that they will lose Mosul. They might put up a tedious and deadly rearguard action, but they will lose it. And if they then start to lose territory in Syria, up to and including Raqqa, does it make them less powerful? And I guess does it put them on a descending spiral during which they can't attract recruits if people think that they are now a busted flush?
I think Raqqa is the key there. It's much more important than Mosul, not just from a logistical point of view, but from a symbolic point of view, that it shows diminishing power of the organization. But I think we have heard a couple of times in recent years this sort of death knell for ISIS, that when they lost particular military battles, but particularly in Iraq, that this was supposed to lead to the disintegration of the organization. In fact, we then saw it regroup very quickly and come back in a slightly different form. That's because of the type of organization that ISIS is. It's not a classical army. It is very loosely formed. It seems to rely on this very fluid kind of constellation of battalions that can, you know, sort of morph away and then rejoin at certain times. So it's the kind of organization that could maybe take some serious hits and then reform, but the taking of Raqqa, I think, would be extremely serious.
Sebastian, in confronting Islamic State, is the only way forward just a continual military grinding away at them? We were reminded this week by the passing of Martin McGuinness that there can come a time in certain situations at which you do have to, well, not only have to talk to people, but can actually make progress by talking to people, however obnoxious or objectionable you may happen to find them, or indeed how obnoxious and objectionable they may happen to be. But in looking at the specific case of Islamic State, does it strike you that there's anything there that anybody can negotiate with?
I would have thought, I mean, I hope very much that the authorities involved are trying to do that. You know, you've got to find, I mean, IS isn't one one front. It's individuals, and you will, if you have enough intelligence on who is involved, you will try to find those who you can talk to, and or at least attempt to talk to, and then see how you can maybe drive wedges between them. But anyway, give them a way out. You've got to give them a way out. I mean, I'm thinking of the, I think it's now more than 800. British citizens who have travelled there and have gone to fight with IS. Now, if they survive, let's hope they do. Where do they go, and how do we treat them? That's absolutely the key question. And in the end, you cannot. That's proven in Northern Ireland. You must. As you say, however much you, John Major, the former British Prime Minister, described it as gut-wrenching. You know, you don't want to do it, but you've got to do it. You've got to talk to the other side. You never make peace with your friends. You have to make peace with your enemies.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Sebastian Borger and Phil Clark. Coming up next, the Catholic Church, normally in the business of dispensing forgiveness, asks for it.
How much information can you pack into a minute? Every morning, the Monocle Minute wings its way into your inbox, packed with the very latest news and views from around the world, all delivered with a monocle twist. We'll tell you what that new aircraft carrier means for Southeast Asia, why the next EU summit will be more interesting than normal, and what to look out for at an upcoming election. We'll pick out the latest retail trend in Latin America, analyse the aviation news in Australia, and take a tour of a neighbourhood that's on the up. And there's more. At the weekend, we'll review the best new restaurants, give you the lowdown on that art exhibition you've been meaning to visit, and dissect the best of the latest fashion week. See? There's rather a lot you can pack into a minute. Sign up now at monocle.com/minute.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Sebastian Borger and Phil Clark. Now, coming up for 23 years since the beginning of the Rwanda genocide, recollections of the events still have a power to shock. At least 800,000 people murdered in 100 days, almost all of them without weapons even as sophisticated and distancing as guns. In a crime of such magnitude, there was and is a great deal of blame to go around. Pope Francis, after meeting with Rwanda's president, Paul Kagame, has accepted his church's share of it and ask for forgiveness. Phil, what specifically is Francis asking for forgiveness of?
He was a little vague in his request for forgiveness. I think the short answer is we don't exactly know, but certainly the Catholic Church's complicity in the Rwandan genocide is all-encompassing. I mean, the Catholic churches were used as sites for the incitement of ethnic killings. Churches were, of course, locations of large massacres. Priests and nuns were involved in mass murder. And since the genocide, the Catholic Church has been heavily involved in harboring many genocide perpetrators. So
that was a detail that struck me, because you have to wonder, at no point in their sort of attempts to sort of remove and shelter genociders did anyone involved in the Catholic hierarchy think, gee, does this remind us of anything?
Yeah, that's right. You would think that history would speak loudly on this particular issue. And we have seen the Catholic Church increasingly try to come to terms with its involvement in the Holocaust. But this is the big bugbear for the Rwandan government. I mean, clearly, President Kagame went to the Vatican on Monday, gave a press conference after this request for forgiveness and said, basically, it's about time, but it's a good thing that the Vatican has done this. However, if they're really serious about this apology and request for forgiveness, they now need to hand over the tens, possibly hundreds of quite senior Catholic personnel who are all scattered around the world, who are known to have been involved in genocide events. So I think that's the thing that Rwanda's looking for now, is for them to hand over those perpetrators and to see them receive justice.
Sebastian, do you think there is, well, I guess, what value is there in the historical apology? Pope Francis is not personally complicit in any of this, he's not the first institution or government in recent years especially to have apologised for something that happened not necessarily on their watch quite a long time ago. Who does it help? Is it mostly for the people doing the apologising, or does it help the people being apologised to?
I think it depends very much, as Phil has pointed out, as to whether or not you're following up your apology with deeds, or indeed maybe sometimes deeds have gone before the apology. I'm thinking, of course, of the apology that the then Prime Minister David Cameron gave for Bloody Sunday, the massacre of 14 unarmed civilians in 1972 by the British Army in Northern Ireland. The same is true, of course, of the Catholic Church in Ireland, which has had to confront the decades of child abuse. There's a lot of complaints again about a lack of cooperation with the investigating authorities, and as long as you don't give that cooperation, your apology is worth very little.
Hey, Phil, you and I both come from a country where the question of historical apology has not necessarily dominated, but figured in politics over the last few decades. Specifically, the degree to which the Indigenous people of Australia are owed an apology by the government of Australia. And I guess, again, it's the same question. The apology was eventually made. John Howard as Prime Minister refused to. Kevin Rudd as Prime Minister did. But does it actually make a difference to anything?
I think it does. I think the symbolism of these acts is very important, if only because it draws a line between the actions of the past and the desires for the future. It at least says we acknowledge that wrong has been done. There are actors who carry very direct responsibility for these atrocities of the past. But I think the same criticism was made of Rudd's apology in Australia, as we're seeing with the Catholic Church vis-a-vis Rwanda this week, which is a lack of active follow-through. In the Australian case, this has involved big big calls for restitution and reparation. In the case of Rwanda, it's about wanting to deliver justice to perpetrators. And there's a very particular angle to Rwanda's anger this week, which is that it's not just the Catholic Church per se that they're asking should hand over perpetrators. It's the Catholic Church in France, which is very particularly wrapped up in this. Most of the Catholic genocide there who are overseas at the moment are based in France, and that's also connected to France's lack of acknowledgement of its role in the Rwandan genocide.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we will look quickly at Scotland, the parliament of which was debating First Minister Nicola Sturgeon's call for a second referendum on Scottish independence before proceedings were suspended following today's events at Westminster. Sebastian, it is expected that Holyrood, the Scottish Parliament, will back her demands for a second referendum on independence. Theresa May, the UK Prime Minister, has already said they can't have it, at least not in the immediate future. So if the Scottish MPs do back her, then what?
Well, then the game goes on, as you pointed out. I mean, it's technically, of course, only backing a mandate for the First Minister to go to Westminster and ask for the referendum to be legally binding.
When she will be told that no, it won't be, and no, you can't.
But interestingly, you've got to be precise. Interestingly, of course, Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, has not said you can't do it. What she has said is now is not the time, and she's refused the obvious follow-up question. Well, when is the time? And you can see the Conservatives playing for time. First of all, for time, I suppose, to get their Brexit negotiations out of the way. Then even more so, possibly, to attempt to prolong it to the next Scottish parliamentary elections in 2021, and generally prolong it and see whether the SNP in power, which I mean, the Nationalists have now been in power in Edinburgh for 10 years. And the iron laws of politics, of course, tell us that governments get ground down and lose popularity, which the SNP and Nicola Sturgeon have withstood so far, this law. But it, sooner or later, it will catch up with them.
I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing Theresa May and the rest of the Conservative government spending the next few years telling the Scots that it would be madness to leave a successful economic trading bloc without any idea of what the future holds. Sheer madness. But there is a weird thing, Phil, with Scottish nationalism in that it seems to be the exception that people who normally decry all other forms of nationalism will allow. And I'm just wondering, when you measure the drive for Scottish independence against other populist / Yahoo movements around the world, does it rate alongside those? Is it a sort of atavistic tantrum along the lines of Brexitism or Trumpism or Le Penism, or is it something else that deserves being considered separately?
Well, I think listening to voices north of the border, there's a sense that being a Scot or the idea of Scottish nationalism is about a very different brand of politics from what you see in the rest of the UK. So I think they, certainly the SNP, would try to frame this as a certain type of centre-leftist politics that seems to be very much on the wane in the UK at the moment. And they're very proud of their public healthcare system and their free higher education and things like that in the north. So I think that, yes, there is a sort of an antagonism towards England. There is this kind of, you know, deep historical root, but there's also a sense that politics is being done differently north of the border, and that is being quashed by what we're seeing out of Westminster at the moment.
Being paid for by London, of course.
Indeed.
A deficit of 9.5%.
The slight wrinkle in the Scottish argument.
This is why I'm not convinced it's actually ever going to happen. Sebastian, could the UK end up breaking itself up in its desire to take back control, do you think, just quickly? No,
well, it could, but I'm with you. I think Nicola Sturgeon, who is a cautious and clever politician, is playing a long game of grievance. And I wonder whether she actually wants this referendum. I think she's trying to coax Theresa May off the hard Brexit course. I think that's basically her strategic aim.
Well, politicians calling for referendums they don't really want hardly ever goes wrong. Sebastian Borger and Phil Clark, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Naomi Joseph. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Music next at 1900. It's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. More on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I'll be your host for that as well. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.